off in search of water, the Idan did Tzlusa at the time when he should have been davening. Okay? Well, I say, I mean, you know, if let's say it's a question of davening Shmonesa together with the Eilam. So it's better to do that than to, you know, delay and go searching for water or something like that. It would be better, according to this opinion, the Rabbi just thought. All right, I think we shall stop at this particular point. But I'm a little bit tired after my running around
your journey to New York,
visiting the Beis Salems and Chasson.
So will we meet again?
So, okay, Mitz Hashem, we'll meet 2 weeks from tonight.
2 weeks from tonight.
2 weeks from tonight, right.
What time that'll be right after Mitz Hamar?
Yeah, after Mitz Hamar. I think at that time we'll be done in Mitz at about 6:45. Right. So, yeah. Listen, the sooner we start, the sooner we finish. Good. It's as simple as all that.
So we're now
still when it gets even earlier, you know, like later in October or something like that, then maybe we'll start our shir at about 7:30 in the evening. But for the time being, let's stick to the fact that after Mitz Hamar will meet. So 2 weeks from tonight, in Yotzeh Hashem, during the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, 10 days of repentance, will come here and we'll be Balei Tshuva.
Balei Tshuva. Well, we're still in Perek Shlishi.
Right. Yeah. Well, we have a few more dapim.
Amid Aleph.
Yeah. So we start down at the bottom over here. Next thing. Over. As to, you know, what standards to apply. In America,
they have to remove the thigh.
Yeah, so but also certain veins have to be removed.
Thigh veins that
carry.
Is this a vein that they're removing or a bone?
This happens to be a sinew that they remove.
Sinew.
So they're reading the hind quarter too.
In Eretz Israel, they can if they remove it.
They're taking out the vein.
It doesn't look beautiful. You see the difference. In America, you want to have a piece of meat that looks gorgeous in the showcase.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So they felt it was too much of an effort already in order to do it, and since there are so many goyim in America who want to eat the meat at, you know, at the same time,
and
so
goyim
this is
Tuesday.
Why we eat the four quarters of the animal and the you know, the hind quarters go to the goyim. Okay, so
that they don't have to do it.
Correct. But in Eretz Israel, where meat is much more scarce, so there they do have people who are expert in nikur, so that they can remove, you know, the prohibited sinews, veins that have to go along with it. Then in that case, then the hind quarter could be eaten. But you know, it looks chopped up. I mean, it doesn't have to look similar.
You can get a porterhouse steak in Israel.
What it tastes like.
I wouldn't know what it tastes
never.
Like.
What's that?
But, you know, you don't have that many goyim over there. It's told us doesn't have so many goyim, so they said. But as a matter of fact, there's a different problem too in Eretz Israel. In general, they don't raise their own cattle, you realize that. Yeah. There isn't room enough for that. So that
the cattle's drinking, whatever it is.
Yeah, right. The bunch of pioneers drink the cattle over there. You know,
yeah, they are. They're right. Like lots of sinews.
So, as a result, a great deal of the meat has to be imported. Probably the majority of the meat in Venezuela is imported. Comes from Argentina, from Brazil, from Ethiopia, comes from those countries.
Australia,
yeah, Australia too, possibly, right. So the result is, you know, that you have to have shochtim who meet the approval of the Eretz Yisrael rabbinah. In many cases, they'll send out their own shochtim over there. In other cases, if they know that you know, the rabbi in charge is very, very particular, and he has expert shochtim working on the inn, so they'll accept it simply on the basis of the letter of recommendation, you know. That
but from Argentina, it's really kosher, isn't it? Traded kosher before it comes.
The chances are that it would be, because if you're going to keep it for any length of time, you know, I mean, that meat has to be washed before 72 hours have passed.
Sure.
Yeah.
And only for 3 times.
Well, this is a limit too, because otherwise, yeah.
Well, unless you're kosher.
You can kosher it, right. Either you kosher it the regular way before the time period is over, or meat of that type might possibly be broiled and eaten as broiled meat. And
how long
broiling
after,
is the
how
kosher
long afterwards?
Meat.
Can't be
well,
forever?
Can't be forever. It wouldn't taste like anything either. Mm. Yeah. But technically, if you haven't washed it within, you know, if you haven't washed it or made it kosher within 3 days, then that meat could be used by broiling. That's the practicality, it can be.
You mean if somebody takes chopped meat?
Yeah.
And they don't have to kosher if they can broil it?
Well, with chopped meat, again, so you say here you have to know if it's pure
chopped
meat, without anything else in it or not. And of course, you know, in many cases, you know, the butcher has expanded the chop meat. If you know what I mean, he adds, let's say, crumbs and things like that. I mean, you couldn't do it once you add it. But if we're 100% pure chop meat, it might possibly be royal.
Right.
We don't want to take a chance on those things, and this is the reason why we insist that all chop meat be broiled, be kosher beforehand. Right.
Coming back to the original question, you say they inspect the intestines with the same care that they inspect the lungs.
Yeah, they have to inspect.
That's a big job.
It is.
The kidneys and the bladder
certain
and all.
Certain things you rely upon the fact that normally you don't find problems in that area. So that the do a superficial, the dika, your yaitza, you have conformed with the law. But, of course, if afterwards, you know, you discover that there's something wrong, then already that becomes a shaitan. You have to determine whether the animal is kosher or trade, okay? But for an average area which is not too susceptible to something going wrong, you don't have to do it. But they do have, you know, as I said, the bedikas panim, you examine inside, you examine outside. But the lungs proved to be the biggest problem when it came to cattle. And that's the reason why. That requires more inspection than the other parts of the anatomy. Now with chickens, fowl in general, this is already a different problem. Because they have a tendency to eat, let's say,
gravel.
Horns, gravel, whatever it may be, you know, things that might possibly perforate
a nail.
Right. So that you have to watch for. This is why a chicken has to be examined differently. Then the lungs is not a problem for the chicken. But the gizzard, that's a problem. The pupik, this is a problem.
Gizzard is
the pupik.
That, or even the Helsel people examine. I mean, there's different things that they
that's
examine.
Like, you know,
so those things have to be examined. Of course, another problem, too, is the question whether it has gallbladder, the liver, but it has to be examined also. So these are some
things. You're talking for the cow?
For the cow, but also even for an animal.
Chicken.
For a chicken, yeah.
Where would an animal like in the United States, a tuberculin-tested herd?
Yeah.
Very vital. Where would that
be? Omid Aleph, down towards the bottom over
Kof
there.
Bays.
Kof Bays, Omid Aleph, down at the bottom. Okay, near the bottom. Not exactly at the bottom, but near the bottom. Okay. All right. I just wanted to conclude again with the last things that last mamor that you know the last statement that we had last week at the end of the year.
We're still working, of course. The whole thing started out, if you remember, with the whole thing with Takana says. Maybe tonight we'll finally get finished with the entire sugya, as we would say about. Sugya means, a section within the Talmud itself that deals with a particular inyan, you see. That's what they call a sugya, okay? In other words, the discussion in that particular area revolves about one central theme, okay? In this case, happens to be Takkonis Ezra, okay? And whether it was observed or not observed, and if so, and why, and so on and so forth. So, this is it. But the last statement that we had last week, I give out.
Two weeks ago.
Okay. Yeah. It said over there that, Rabbi Yehuda ben Gamliel, Lomer, Mishum Rabbi Hanin ben Gamliel, that Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Gamliel, said in the name of Rabbi Hanin ben Gamliel, I'm just reviewing the last few lines that we had last time. Not the bottom, but it's in the middle of the page, down a few lines. He said, he said that whether, can you study Mishnah, can you study Gemara, the Baal Keri shouldn't study either of them around, the Amri law, and some say, Zevzeh Muta, right? And others say, on the contrary, everything is permissible, right? So it says, Mando, Man Zevzeh Osur, the one who says that it makes no difference, whether it's Mishnah, whether it's Gemara, whatever it may be, it is prohibited, or whether it's prayer even, this is Karabi Yochanan Hasamla. In other words, he follows the strict opinion that was given by Yochanan Hasamla.
All right. But Manda Oma and Zebazem Mutar, the one who said that it makes no difference which area we're talking about, it is permissible for Balkeri to study and to indulge in all these things, he says, this is Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. This follows the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. All right. Naturally, of course, whose opinion are we going to follow? We're going to follow Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. We're going to follow it. All right. And how do we know that we should follow it? Because it says, Amarach Nachman by Yitzchak, the Rab Nachman by Yitzchak said that Nohu Galmo Kahani Tlatsobe. It says that the Welt Tilzik, this is what it means, Nohu, you know, is Tilzik, the world acts, the world does, Nohe.
Nohe.
Well, right, here it doesn't mean drives, but the world, you know.
What is it? From Einzig, the person Nicho Eretz.
Yeah, the beast kind.
So working on it.
He'll learn Hebrew before he'll learn Yiddish.
I'm telling you, it's a big loss to me.
So if you know Yiddish, you should know half the words are Hebrew anyway.
Hebrew cannot approach the colorfulness of Yiddish.
I wouldn't say it can. But there's a certain feel, you know, I mean, particularly if you've heard Mama Loshen or something like that, you've grown up with it, that you don't lose.
Right.
And there's no question even that it has even influenced the English language. No question.
Oh, sure.
When I hear Goyim on the TV using words like schlep, Ganif, and who knows what else, I mean, obviously there has been some influence upon it.
Mishigas,
I mean, all kinds of, you know, there's different words that I get. Coming out of the mouths of pure Goyim.
Not Jewish Goyim, but Goyim.
Goyim. So, anyway, he says that the world carries on. The world acts, okay? Really, the word is acts. We're looking for the precise English word, okay? The world acts kahane tlasavi, according to these three sove. Sove means, literally, elderly people, but here it means like sages, these three sages. Because, after all, what is the Hebrew word for a sage? It's a zokin. Alright, so zokin can refer to years, but zokin can also refer, you know, to experience and knowledge and everything else. You see, those of us who already reached the stage where we speak about mature individuals, so we recognize the fact, you know, that as a zokin we benefit from all the experience that we've had in life, and you know, it should enable us at least to know a little bit, you know, how we should conduct ourselves. David,
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but where precisely are we?
Okay.
Now that you're going,
you see what it says, I'm not going by Yitzhak. You see where it says Chulin Kof Lamed Vav on the outside margin? Look in the margin.
Okay.
All right. Go up. You see where it says Chulin Kof Lamed Vav?
Yeah.
Okay. Go down one line.
Okay.
All right.
Rav Nachman. Okay.
Right. So I'm Rav Nachman by Yitzchok. Rav Nachman by Yitzchok said, No Galmo Kehani Klosavi, that the world acts in accordance with these three stages. Rabbi Eloi Bereshis HaGeis, they follow the opinion of Rabbi Eloi Bereshis HaGeis. Rabbi Yoshio Bekilayim, they follow the opinion of Rabbi Yoshio when it comes to Kilayim. Kilayim, remember, means mixtures. Particularly here, it's agricultural mixtures that we're talking about. Of course, you also have, as we pointed out, right, that sharpness is what we call Kilei HaBeged. In other words, it's Kilayim that we find in a garment where we know that wool and linen is a prohibited mixture. Not woolen polyester, not woolen cotton. I mean, this is permissible, but wool and linen is prohibited. Okay. And
isn't linen basically cotton?
No, they're two different plants.
Right.
Cotton is a plant. It's a special plant called the cotton plant. Okay. And linen is derived from the flax plant. Okay. So that, you know, when they take the, like, it's like a woolly substance and fibers and so that they make out of it. So this is the basis for it. Yeah. Good evening, Bob. How are you? How was the minyan at Kesser? All right?
Yeah.
Good. So, and they act. Yeah. And let's see, where did I drop this? Yeah. Okay. Right. Right. And yes,
Kilayim.
Wait a minute. Oh, here we are. All right. Rabbi Yosha ben Kilayim, right. And then Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, and they followed the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, the Divrei Torah. In other words, when it comes to studying words of Torah, then they follow his opinion, which, as we said a couple of lines before, that Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira said, Zeh v'zeh mutar, that it makes no difference whether it's davening, whether it's learning, and so on, whatever area of learning is permissible. All right? But he goes in again into a deeper explanation of what it is that he said. Rabbi Eli, Bereshis HaGez, they follow the opinion of Rabbi Eli in connection with the Reshis HaGez, which, as I explained, when you shear a sheep, then the first block of wool that you shear from it, I don't mean the entire, you know, all the wool, but you have to take a portion of the wool and give it to the Kohen. All right? So he says that this, he says, Einu Noheg Ela Ba'aretz. This is only applicable in Eretz Yisrael. Now, of course, the question is whether today is applicable. The answer is no. It's not applicable today because of what reason? Can we think of a reason? Remember that this has to be given to the Kohen.
So there's no Beis HaMikdash.
Right. There's no Beis HaMikdash.
There's no sacrifices.
There are no sacrifices. And we also say that a Kohen, we're not 100% sure that they're in a state of purity today. Although, you know, many Kahanim feel that they are, and, you know, many particularly are very vigilant, I mean, to make sure that they don't go on a Beis Salem, except with the Torah itself commanded, you know, that Chas v'Shalom, if you have to bury, you know, a parent or a brother or, the very, very closest relatives, you see, a wife, you know, then in that particular case, the Kohen has to be Metame, he must go. But the problem is that our Kohanim are all of them Tameim. And how can a Kohen become Tahor? Right. You have to be sprinkled with the Pora Aduma besides going to Mikvah. Right. Mikvah is no problem. But the Pora Aduma, this is the problem. We don't have a Pora Aduma. So therefore, since every Kohen is considered as being in a state of Tumah, therefore, not only do we not give him the Reishis HaGez, we don't give him Challah either. What do we do with Challah today? You burn it, right. I mean, the Balabosto or the baker, or whatever it is, you know, burns a piece of Challah that they take instead of giving it to the Kohen. Ancient times, you know, it was given to the Kohen. Now, with Truma, again, you can't give, you know, Truma to the Kohen. Ancient times, this was on the Matnas Kahuna. What are you going to do with it? You can't do it today, okay? Or the lechayim and the keva, the cheeks of an animal which was sacrificed, okay, or the belly part of the animal, or the zeroa, in other words, the forelegs, okay, of the animal that they used to give to a kohen as a gift, okay. So these you can't give anymore. Naturally, there's no such thing as chatos, you know, that was the exclusive privilege of a kohen to eat, or the oshem that, again, only a kohen could eat. Can't have any of these things, because we don't have a base of mikdash, we don't have a por aduma, the efer apor, you know, the ashes, so that, therefore, for all practical purposes, even in Eretz Yisrael, Reishis HaGez is no longer applicable. But, in accordance with his opinion, if we had a Beis HaMikdash and everything was all right, the people who are not in Eretz Yisrael would still what?
Be potter.
They would be potter, exactly. They would not have to give the Reishis HaGez to the Kohen. This is only, he says, something which is Talui Boretz. It depends on the existence of Eretz Yisrael.
If they found a Poros Ima just for argument's sake, but don't have a Beis HaMikdash, they can't sacrifice it, can they?
I'll tell you the truth. I would say no at this particular point, but I'm not 100% certain about it. Why am I not certain about it? There is one sacrifice, namely the Korban Pesach. Okay? Korban Pesach, of course, has to be eaten Betara, Gansbein. Okay?
Betara.
It has to be eaten Betara. Nevertheless, the Gemara raises the question. What would happen if Rov Yisrael lo betara? In other words, the majority of Jews were not. You see, when the majority of Jews are tahor, in other words, they've gone to the mikvah and the Beis HaMikdash and everything else and so on, then, in that case, someone who is unclean cannot shech the korban Pesach and eat it. Okay? But what happens if the majority of the Jews are tamei and not tahor? Then in that case, there's a dictum that we find in the Talmud that says that tumo hutra b'tzibur. In other words, if you have a tzibur, if you have the masses of the Jewish people are tamei, then in that case it becomes permissible. Therefore, according to this opinion, the Korban Pesach would be permitted. Now, there are those who carry this one step further, and they say that it would be permissible, therefore, even on this basis, that we should shech the Korban Pesach and eat it, even though we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. Now, I'm not saying that this is the prevailing opinion, but nevertheless, the idea has been advanced by some authorities, and as I say, I mean, it's a respectable idea, except that we don't accept it, that's all. But it's not Stam Shtus, you see. I mean, there's a good reason halachically why it is permissible. So that's why, in answer to the question about if we were to find a Parah Teduma today, whether we really have to have the Beis HaMikdash in order to shecht it or not, this I don't know. It is possible that under the same general rule there may be a Parah Teduma too. Why? Because the Parah Teduma was not an ordinary sacrifice. It doesn't follow the rules of the other sacrifices. It's an exception. Even though the Torah refers to it as a chatos, as a sin offering, but nevertheless, it is not technically like the other
sacrifices
that we call a chatos, in other words, the sin offering, which, if you remember, first of all, the chatos, the general rule for a chatos is, when did a person bring a chatos? He brought it if he had unknowingly violated a law in the Torah, okay? A law which would particularly involve either kores or whatever, you know, one of the most difficult punishments, you know, if he had done it purposely. If he had, you know, in all, he didn't realize what he was doing. He didn't know, for example, that it was Shabbos. Or he didn't know that a particular action of his was a violation of Shabbos or something like that, okay? He didn't know it. So in that case, when he becomes aware of the fact that, you know, he had committed an error, so therefore in order to atone for it, would bring a chatas. And of course what would happen then, you know, he would bring the chatas to the Beis HaMikdash, they would shech the chatas, and then the kahanim would eat it, okay? This is the rule concerning the chatas. But the Parah Aduma, even though it's called a chatos in the Torah, doesn't follow this rule at all, because what do they do with the korban?
They burn it outside the camp.
It has to be burned outside the camp, not in the Beis HaMikdash. Exactly. All this is absolutely right. These are the rules and technicalities. So that this is the reason why I say, if it were to be burned outside the camp, then maybe there would be a good reason also, if there were a Parah Aduma today, that, you know, it could be done. But as I say, that I leave to other authorities.
Yes. They're getting very close now because they've been working with red heifers
in order
Sweden
to breed them,
to crossbreed them.
Because
now they're getting a, you know, like you have a Vadia Yosef going out, and see pictures of him talking to cowboys, if you will, in Israel, from family,
cattle breeder,
right? Yeah, they're importing these.
We're
getting close.
Well, listen, it is possible. Who knows? You know, we're living in an age, as the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, it's an age of miracles, right? Tavshinun Aleph, hopefully your miracles and so on. So we'll see. In the meantime, I can tell you I spoke to my son tonight to wish him the Gemara Chasima Tova, and thank God everything is well. So we shouldn't panic and we shouldn't be afraid. I don't go. And I was particularly pleased. He told me that I received a letter from him a few days ago, and also tonight he repeated. He is now giving a course in Sefer Yehoshua. He's teaching a class in his shul over there, and he has quite a few people who are interested. They come together and they learn. He's teaching the course.
Yeah,
well, so Shep Nachas. Shep Nachas also, he davened the Shachris, Rosh Hashanah is coming to be davening Shachris Yom Kippur.
That's just
so,
hope there's no war, that's all.
Well, that's what we hope for. Right. We hope it'll be great.
The Mishogener over there in Baghdad, right? Yeah. They should have a Missa Mishona.
Right, they should drop dead. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, door by door.
So I was very proud of him.
Yes, very nice. Yeah.
Okay, so much for the Reishis HaGeis, all right? Now, how about the Kilayim? So, Kerabi Yosha B'Kilayim, so he says, in what way, you know, what was his opinion? So, what Rabbi Yosha has said, well, the Torah says, right, the Torah says, Lo Sizra Kilayim. The reason why I'm leaving out the word karmic, although it is found, is because there's a more general prohibition. The truth, as I explained to you, is that there are two psukim prohibiting kilayim. One of them simply says lo sizra kilayim, and the other one says karmic lo sizra kilayim. Now, karmic means literally your vineyard. So that therefore, from this we learn your vineyard, kerem is the vineyard, right?
Yeah.
So from this we learn then that kilayim is prohibited in two different areas. Kilayim is prohibited in the field. It's written sod cholos is rakilayim. This is what the first pasuk says. Sod cholos is rakilayim. Okay. So it is prohibited in the field, meaning, you know, let's say things that grow in the field, such as oats, barley, or even different types of vegetables, that they should not be mixed in helter-skelter. The law of kilayim is that when you plant, you should have separate beds with a little separation between one and the other, so that the roots should intermingle, but, you know, each species should be by itself, okay? This is the law of kilayim. All right? And then, of course, the vineyard specifically is mentioned in the Torah. All right, so that therefore, what was his opinion? He was more, as we would say, more makel. In other words, he was more lenient than some of the other authorities who said, oh, the slightest thing that you have to do, as the Mishnah says at the beginning of Shkolim, that you have to pull out immediately. You have to pull out whatever you see. The minute you can see that there is kilayim in the field, the first thing you have to do is pull it out. That's it, okay? And that, in general, by the way, is the law. I mean, this is what should be done. But he was a little more lenient as to his interpretation of kilayim, because he said, Li'olam, in truth, he says, Eino chayav, that the person is not chayav, in other words, he's not guilty, so that he has to do what? As I said a moment ago, he has to bring a chatos because of the fact that he's violated a negative commandment in the Torah. Okay? So he's not guilty, ad she yizra chitos or v'chatz ban pelashyad, until he actually takes wheat and barley, which are, of course, two different grains, right? The chartzon, which is grape seeds, and throws them into the ground, the mapolis yod, with one shot. This is really violating kilayim, and for this he has to bring a chatas, okay? But otherwise, he has to, of course, you know, pull out what doesn't belong over there, but he's not obligated to bring a korban chatas for having violated the din, you know,
kilayim.
Sorech olos is rakilayim, and then the other one, you know, that karmic olos is rakilayim. Okay? Yes.
Well, whenever I've read this, I'm always a little confused, because I can understand about the fields.
Yeah.
But the part about the vineyards,
Hold it. Well, it means specifically that within the vineyard itself, you should not plant any other plants other than the vineyard.
Oh, okay.
That's what they mean by that, okay? That's why they single out karmakolos israkilayim. So again, as I say, sodkolos israkilayim, then you have karmakolos israkilayim, and then, of course, you have the first pasuk continues, behemtechor lo sabia kilayim, which means that you're not allowed to crossbreed animals of different species. Not talking about maybe two different types of, let's say
cattle,
but I mean, to take, let's say, a cow and a buffalo or something like that, right? You know, something like that, which is not a normal type of a mixture, and crossbreed them. This is also prohibited. And then, of course, beged kilayim shatnez, Torah says, and a garment which is, you know, a shatnez, which we define in another pasuk, which tells us it's semer pishnim. Okay, in other words, it is wool and flax in the same garment.
So that and lo subash, right? They're not allowed to wear a garment at that time. So that these are the different types of kelayim that the Torah mentions. But Rabbi Yoshia says, in order to be liable to bring a korban, so for that, it's only if you violate, all the prohibitions, all the agricultural prohibitions that are mentioned. Okay. So, again, as I say, his opinion is more makild, he's more lenient than others who would say that we'd have to bring a korban chatos, even for, let's say, an agricultural admixture which had nothing to do with the vineyard. Okay? And finally, what about the Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseirah b'divrei Torah? That, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseirah, the halacha follows him as far as the study of Torah is concerned. The Sanya, as we learned, he says, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseirah, Emer. He says, Ein divrei Torah mekabin tumah. Remember I spoke about that? That the words of Torah are not susceptible to uncleanliness. And this is why I told you that Rav Shenko, Valer Shalom Potskin, that a woman is permitted to touch the Sefer Torah, right. And it's not a violation because the Torah itself is an Ishtos, it's like a
fire
Torah, fire. Right? That's why it says they divrei Torah mekabin tumah. He also Ziri, when Ziri came, so it says, Omar, he said, also always means in this particular case that when he came, let's say, from a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, he came to Babylonia, and so he reported, naturally they asked him, so what did you learn in Eretz Yisrael? So he told him, he says, Bidluha litpilusa, he said that they have done away with the tevila, in other words, the immersion. The Yamrilay and others say that's not what he said, but he said bitluha linetulusa, that he did away with the washing of the hands. So mandom bitluha linetulusa, those who say that he did away, with the that they've done away, literally with the tevila, with the immersion in the mikveh for studying Torah. So that's the Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseirah. That follows his opinion. Man the Yomah Bitluhalim Tulosa, and the one who follows the opinion that says that what they said in Eretz Israel was that they did away with washing their hands, it's Kihoda Rav Chista. This was in reference to the statement of Rav Chista that Layat Amanda Mahadra Maya Bilin Slesa. He literally curses out, but that's not what it means. What it means is that he is angry with a person who looks for water at the time when he should be saying Shemoneh Esrei. In other words, if the Yalam is saying Shmanesh, but that don't go out of your way in order to look for water, but spend Dabin with them. Right, this is what the meaning is. Naturally, normally, we should try to wash our hands prior to davening, but if the Yalam is saying Shmanesh, then stay Shmanesh with them. You can see how important the whole idea is of Tefillah B'Tzibur, how important it is to daven as a member of a congregation. Now, this is one of the most important concepts they have. We all know that we're permitted to daven privately. We have an obligation for davening. But there is so much more merit in davening with a minyan, if you possibly can, that be a member of the minyan. But this also means something else. And that is, when you come into a shul, try as much as possible to be at the point where the congregation is. I remember many months ago I spoke about, what happens, for example, in the morning. Okay? You come in a little bit late. What should you do? Try to sling in the whole davening and not count as a member of the congregation? Or should you rather omit some of the things that may be omitted according to the Shulchan Aruch, okay? And daven as a member of a congregation. And of course, the halacha follows the fact that, for example, if you come in Pesukah Dezimra, then in that particular case, skip some of the paragraphs in Sukkah Dezimra. If you say Baruch Sheyomar, you say Ashrei, you say Yishtabach, you've already said the minimum of, what is required in the Sukkah Dezimra. Naturally, if you have time to add more, like some of the Hallelujahs, all right, or Yosha, whatever it may be, God's fine. In that case, you do as much as you can. The brachas, remember what I said. The brachas you should really say at home, at all possible, okay? Which is, be honest, this is what I do. I wake up in the morning, and the first thing I do after I wash my hands is, to say brachas to myself.
Yeah. You call them because one of
Karbonas, I say at home usually, or else I'll say it over here while waiting,
the whole Karbonas.
No, again, you're not required to say everything, okay? You know that there are many passages in there, but again, our tendency is that we skip certain areas. For example, if you take a look in the average sitter, you'll find that right after the brachas, okay, you have the Parshas Vaakeda with a preceding paragraph and then a paragraph which follows. There's nothing wrong with wanting to say it, but on the other hand, it's not really obligatory. We're doing it as part of Torah study, and because the whole theme of the Akedah is so important to us, the idea that Abraham, Isaac were willing to sacrifice themselves on behalf of the people of Israel, that therefore God's mercy should be aroused towards the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham and Isaac, and, you know, save us for their sake, okay? But are we required to say it? No. What would happen if we didn't say it? So you didn't say it, that's all, okay? Now, in many Siddurim, you'll also find...
Why don't you say the preceding paragraph and the paragraph that follows it?
No.
You don't say that?
No,
either.
Then you wouldn't say either the preceding paragraph or the paragraph that follows. Instead, after, say, put him as a and from there you skip directly to, not the way they do in Kadima over here, and then continue over there, you know. I don't know which great Chacham invented over here that we skip immediately to Leticha Chanachnu.
I remember years ago.
Yeah, but it's not right.
They do Baruch Hashem.
Yeah.
And they did it for a little while, they went back to Leticha.
Yeah.
They were doing it for a while.
For a very short while, right.
Yeah, I remember...
Ira Bernstein had suggested that we go on.
Right.
I had also suggested that we never do it. Right, because this is what we find in many Siddurim. Take a look at Siddurim which are published in England. Or in Germany, okay? But particularly the English Siddurim. You'll see that, you know, this they have, but the Parshas Vaakeda, they say for, at the end, this additional study, okay? And the same thing is true that after, you know, we say the Mekadosh Hashem HaBarabim, then they do include the paragraph which follows, etc. And Tzavos B'nai Yisrael, that they have, okay, it's Parshas HaTamid. And then from there they go right to Ezehu Mekomet. Except if it's Shabbos or Rosh Chodesh, then they have the Yom HaShabbos or Rosh Chodesh, okay? And they go right to Ezehu, and they say all of Ezehu and Rabbi Yishmael, and that's it, okay? This is the way their siddur is arranged, and there's nothing wrong with it, okay? But, you know, we usually say more. So, you know, I say more to myself, but I wouldn't force the congregation to say more. That's the point, okay?
No, they say less.
Recently,
what's the
it seems to me that Rabbi
Yishmael
would put in.
Yeah, this is also true. This was added within the past year or two. This is absolutely correct.
Here at Kadima.
Here at Kadima. Yeah. But I'll explain to you why it was added. It was added for the simple reason. It used to be that we had an Elim coming early in the morning, and they would learn first the Mishnayos or something like that, okay? Shulchan Aruch, whatever, Rambam. And then, this was before davening, okay? Then, of course, the Elim became a little bit lax, and sometimes the rabbi was also a little bit sleepy in the morning, okay? So that he didn't make it in time. Well, when they used to have davening, when they had learning and there was a minyan present, then they could say Rabbanan Kaddish at that particular point, and then they would go on to the regular davening, okay? But since we don't, then there's really no reason why we shouldn't be saying those things which are in the siddur. So at least give an opportunity to the mourners to recite a Kaddish Rabbanan. So that's the basic reason why I stand.
I was under the impression that without studying ahead of time, that some members had been coming over, doubling up from Kesa Israel, and they were so used to saying it. That was my impression.
No, that had nothing to do with Kesa.
Okay.
If you go to Kesa, as a matter of fact, you find they don't say it, period.
They don't say it.
They don't say it. They start with Mizmoshir, excuse me, they don't start with Mizmoshir either. They start with Hoidi. And this is smart, you know. Hodu is said before Baruch Shiyomar. This is Chashanah, as we say Baruch Shiyomar before we say Hodu, okay? So, since at Kesed they follow it's Dusa Chari, but it's fairly close to the Dusa Svart.
Well, what's the minor difference between the two? You saying that before the Fika that you wanted to see that we do again?
Take a look, right. And then the paragraph begins, right, which is the normal thing to lead right into the Ficha. Okay, because the Ficha, the way it's said right now, it doesn't follow anything, the truth of the matter is.
There's no continuity.
Right, there's a logical continuity if you say, Avol Anachdu Amcho B'nei B'Yisecha. Then, logically it's meant to follow that. But the way it's done over here, it's mishnayit, that's all.
It takes like 10 seconds right. more to say.
Right. I don't know why they have to rush for those 10 seconds. I really don't know.
Yeah, it takes 3 yeah. seconds.
Right.
Speedy Sam. Soothing Sam, not really.
Okay, anyway, let's start it with some new material now at this point, and we begin. The Tana Rabbanan, our rabbis have taught us, says, Baal Keri Shenosolov Tishaka B'mayim Tahor. Someone came with the following idea, and he said that if a person is a Baal Keri, right? I think by now we all know what a Baal Keri is, right?
Yeah.
He's had a seminal emission. Okay,
right.
So now I'll use the word Baal Keri and we don't. Okay. But just don't confuse him with the person who reads the Torah.
Let's see how he could.
So, a Baal Keri, upon whom they have poured. This is what it means over here. Nusul means literally given, but it means over here poured. Okay? Right. Upon whom they have poured 9 kabin of water. So, in that particular case, Tahor, he's clean. Now, we have to realize that a kab is a certain liquid measure, okay?
Like a pint.
Right.
A quart.
Now, this liquid measure is much less than in a mikveh, okay? A kab is like, let's say, you poured 9 quarts, okay? If they pour 9 quarts of water upon you, then you are Tahor, okay? Whereas 9 quarts of water will never do in a mikveh. Mikveh requires, as a minimum, 40 sa'ah, which is a much larger measure. Okay? There are books which have been written which give, cubic centimeters and stuff like that.
Know,
what
you want to
compare
it?
Yes.
You know who
gives
that in the new Steinsaltz?
Yeah, Steinsaltz was something.
I saw the beautiful books that he came
Right, the first with. Volume first. Of the, his newly translated work in English.
Well, he also has an introduction, which is also beautiful.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the first part of the Messiah. I'm talking about the general introduction book, which he wrote, the first one, okay? And he has measures over there, but he could also find in some other books as well, okay? So, at any rate, this quantity of water is, needless to say, much less than the 40 so which is required in the mikveh. So, whoever the author of this particular statement is, he says that if 9 kabin of water are poured upon a person who has, undergone, he's a Baal Keri, then in that case, he's already clean, and he can, of course, do what? He can study Torah. Okay. So, when this statement was made, Nochem Ish Gamzu, Nochem, a man who came from Gamzu, it may either be a place name, but of course we prefer a different interpretation of Gamzu. Because the Gemara in Tainus, which tells about Nochem Ish Gamzu, that he met a person. Well, first of all, let me tell you in general, why was he called Gamzu? Because his favorite statement was Gamzu the Toiva.
Gamzu the Toiva.
Right. He'd always say, okay, this too is all right. No matter what happened, no matter what bad is, but, it's Gamzu the Toiva. It's thankful to God that it's not any worse than it is, okay? And there's a Gemara
that says
that a poor man met him and he asked for help. And he wasn't able to help him in time. The man suddenly toppled over and he died. And so Nochem Ish Gamzu said,
the eyes that saw this man and didn't do anything to help him, you know, may they lose their sight, and the hands that saw this man, you know, may they be cut off, etc., etc., and may the feet become paralyzed, and so on and so forth. In other words, you know, talking about himself, because he still would say Gamzu L'tova, and he was grateful to God simply for the ability to be alive. So
he cursed himself.
Yes.
But he wasn't cursed, was he, Masha?
Yes.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, in other words, these things that he asked that God should punish him for this and this and this happened to him.
It did happen. If he couldn't help the man to begin with,
yeah,
why could he have been cursed?
He felt that maybe somewhere or other he was negligent. Had he hastened just a little bit more, maybe had he given the man something to eat or to drink or something like that, the man's life could have been saved. That's the reason why. Okay?
So this Nochem was
a very, very pious person, Nochem Ishkansu. But as I say, there are those who say that is the name of the place rather than, you know. So, all right, whichever it is. But anyway, what happened when the statement was made that a Baal Keri, upon whom they poured 9 kopim of water, that he's now now clean and, you know, he's now able to learn Torah. So he says, Lo chashu l'Rabbi Akiva. Says he whispered this opinion to Rabbi Akiva. Obviously, he was not anxious to broadcast it because, after all, the Takana of Ezra was still very, very much in force. At least people felt that it should be in force. Okay? But Rabbi Akiva, Lochashal ben Azai. And Rabbi Akiva came and he whispered it to Ben Azai. O Ben Azai, Yotza, Ushnol the Talmidov. And then Ben Azai went out and he taught it openly to his Talmidim, Bashuk, in the marketplace, literally. In other words, he publicized this particular din, that just pouring the 9 kopim of water is enough.
Ezra said
that you have to immerse yourself. Now, we're not finished with Ezra yet. We still have a few more details to finish with Ezra. Okay. So, first of all, it says, Man de Tone, the one who taught it openly, right? Man de Tone Ishnor, the one who learns that he taught it openly, why? It's Mishum Bitl Torah. Or Mishum Bitl Pirya Virivya. He says it was because, first of all, there are two reasons why he decided publicly to proclaim that you didn't have to what? Immerse yourself in the mikveh, but it would be enough simply to have 9 kopim water poured upon you. Okay? And he did this because of the fact that, number one, he said that if people are going to be afraid to learn Torah because of the fact that, you know, they're going to become Baal Keri, it means that men would not have relations with their wives. And therefore, it would destroy one of the basic mitzvahs, which is to try to procreate, try to have children as much as you can. Right, okay? So, this is one. That's Mishum Piriya Berivya. And the other one is Mishum Bitl Torah, obviously. You know, if people are going, you know, you want them to study Torah. Now, if you're going to make difficulties in the way of studying Torah, then in that particular case is going to lead to a neglect of Torah. So therefore, for these two reasons, of course, as we said before, this happened to be Ben Azai, who proclaimed openly that the more lenient opinion could be followed. Now, Amandatone Lachosha, and how about the one who only whispered it rather than said aloud? Well, psychologically, he says, he did this because he did not want to see the Talmidei Chachomim hanging around the women's like rooster hanging around the hen all the time. In other words, if people are aware that there are some difficulties, that you're going to subject yourself, you know, to a penalty, you know, by just hanging around and getting the urge for, I guess, nooners and
right.
other occasions or something like that. So in that case, it would naturally cut down on the time that they would have available for study of Torah. They didn't want to encourage that. That's why, even though it was a more lenient view, but he didn't want to proclaim it openly. He only wanted to whisper it.
But someone did proclaim it openly.
Right. Now the Gemara continues and says, "Amar Rabbi Yannai said, Shamati, he says, I heard Shemekilin bo, v'shamat Shemachmirin bo. He says, you know, I heard two different opinions concerning this business about the Tisha Kabin.
Nine
One is that they're Mikilin, in other words, that, you know, they take a lenient view, and another opinion that I heard is that they take a Machmir view. In other words, they say nothing going. It's not enough, and, you know, it's no good. Right. The Chol HaMachmir Bo, Alatz Be'marich Le'yomov Shmeisav. Not only that, but if you are a Machmir upon yourself, then in that case, your days and your years will be lengthened. In other words, the Rebbeinu will reward you for being a Machmir in this particular area. Okay? Of course, this became in general a statement, not just in reference, you know, to the teacher Kabbalah, but in general, that if you try to do things, you know, the more strict point of view, then it's like a segula. It's a good luck charm, so to speak, in order to help you live a longer and a more useful and a happier life. Okay? Now, yes. Yeah, of course it is. Right. This is not a halacha that you have to be a machmir, as I explained to you the last time we had this whole discussion, right? When he said, you know, that he's a makil for others, but a machmir alatzma. This is Rabbi Yehuda who said that, right? So, in other words, as far as myself is concerned, he says, I'm severe with myself, but not with the current, not with the Yelam. The Yelam, he says, one bagel. If there's a reason, you know, where we have a lenient point of view, then, you know, I prefer to take the, right, to take the lenient point of view. So, Omar Rabbi Shur ben Levi, Rabbi Shur ben Levi said, Ma tivon shel toiv le'shachrin. He says, what is the reason, he says, that people go and they're tevil, in other words, they run to the mikveh in the morning? This, by the way, preceded the Kubbalim, you know, the people who studied Kabbalah. This preceded, you know, the people who, you know, like today, for example, let's say many Hasidim have the custom, not necessarily every morning, but certainly as far as on Shabbos or Yontif is concerned, the first they go to the mikveh, and then they go, okay? So he says, what is the reason for those people, and these people apparently would go to the mikveh every single morning? He says, Mativon, what do you mean? What is the reason for it? Well, Ihu the Yomad, isn't, after all, isn't he the one who said, Balkeri also b'divrei Torah? That a Balkeri is, you know, prohibited to study Torah, so therefore that would account for the reason why these people run to the mikveh every morning. So he says, no, that's not exactly what was the point of his question. He says, Hoki Koma. This is really what he meant to say. He says, Ma tivon biar boyim so'or efsho betisha kabin. He says, what is the reason that they go and they title themselves in the 40 so, which is, I explained to you, in other words, why don't they go and take the trouble to go into the mikveh, which requires, you know, a much greater quantity of water, right?
Yeah,
Ma tivon bitvilo, why do they insist upon immersing themselves in the mikveh? Efsho b'nisino, isn't it possible that all they have to do is just, you know, to throw water, the dying cabin of water, and then it'll do the same job?
That's right.
So Omer Rabbi Chanina, so Rabbi Chanina said, Goder Godol Godrubo, he says, actually the reason is, why the reason for the immersion instead of the Tisha Kabin? The Tisha Kabin, he says, would have been sufficient. But the rabbis were more machmir and insisting upon immersion in the mikveh. Why? Because they gave literally a goder. A goder means literally a fence. What it means is that they'll take a more strict point of view in order to prevent some violation of a basic principle. Okay? It's similar to the beginning, you know, what we say in the very beginning of Pirkei Avos, where one of the statements of the Anshik Nesagol is Asus Yog LaTorah, make a fence around the Torah. And, you know, the sages come along and they say, for example, certain actions might theoretically be permitted on Shabbos from the point of view of, is it prohibited midoraisa, is it prohibited in the Torah? But the rabbis added certain prohibitions in order, for example, to make sure that people should not get into the habit of violating things which ultimately would result in the violation of the major principles of Shabbos.
Right.
And the same thing with arroyos, you know, with prohibited relationships, you know, what is permissible, what is prohibited, the same thing. There are certain things that the Torah itself prohibited, and then they went maybe a step or two further in order to discourage anything that is like the arayos that the Torah itself prohibited. Dave, did you want to ask a question?
Oh no.
I can see how that applies to our faith, because what happened with a great many people, everybody's a president, everybody defines its own rules,
right,
so to speak.
Absolutely.
And I always have an idea that if there was a Sanhedrin today, that maybe a Sanhedrin would change, let's say, some of the rules.
Okay.
This is all speculation now. For example, let's say that how people ride today, they ride to a shul, not supposed to ride to a shul
on Shabbos.
On Shabbos.
Right.
Now,
conservative.
But I have always felt that watching, and I'm I'm not that learned, but I've watched my own observations, that the Jewish people, they have a foundation, a house on top and a roof on top of it, but everybody's pulling the bricks quickly from the bottom.
Right.
You take the foundation out, you have no roof.
Yeah.
The roof comes in.
You're absolutely I mean, and take your example of writing, okay? All right. I'm not going into now the technicalities of writing, whether it's permitted or prohibited.
No.
Well, you know that we don't write on Shabbos. Okay.
No.
Actually, this falls, generally speaking, in the area of what I call Shavuos, which means, you know, an additional prohibition in order not to violate the Ikar of the Shabbos, although you might say that there are more things that are involved, I mean, than just, okay? But let's take the example of what happened when the conservative rabbinate came out and they said that it is permissible, it is prohibited to ride on the Sabbath except to a service in the synagogue. Okay? They came out, when is it, maybe about 35, 40 years ago with such a statement, okay? Say it's about 40 years, I would say now. All right? Now, theoretically, this is supposed to encourage
synagogue
the observance of Shabbos and at the same time encourage synagogue attendance.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what happens. What happens is immediately that once you give permission to a person to go and to ride to a shul, they say, nope, if I can ride to a shul, then I can ride to the supermarket.
Or they say, I've already
or
ridden,
whatever
so
it may be.
So,
right, right. And what if you don't have enough gas,
right.
I mean, in the car? So you go and then you buy gas at the pump and everything else.
And
so you can see already, you know, why this breaks down.
I would rather, that's why I'm agreeing, okay, I'd rather see the strict position.
Right.
And somebody keep the tenets of the faith, so to speak, you know, strong.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many tearing it away.
And there are other areas as well. I mean, it's possible that a Sanhedrin could legislate this, that, and the other thing.
Sure.
But before we can get a Sanhedrin, we really have to have some sort of a unity among Jews, which at this moment is non-existent.
Unfortunately.
And secondly, you'd have to have authorities who are recognized by the Torah observant community as being people who have the knowledge in order to be able, you know, to give decisions which would be authoritative and accepted by everyone.
In those areas, wherever they are what's keeping the Judaism keeping it there or else.
Right, absolutely.
On the Siyag HaTorah, my father was correct in saying that on Shabbat, actually, the Av Malachot do not prohibit doing business, buying and selling.
No, but that's not true.
But isn't that what, that was the Siyak al HaTorah that came from the Nevi'im or the Rabbanim?
All right.
Because they were afraid that if you did business, you would write, and also wasn't keeping the spirit of Shabbat.
Well, it certainly is definitely a violation of Shabbat. It's no question that the Nevi'im already were, you know, were inveighing against it. I mean, we read it in Yeshayahu, in Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and so on. That's all of them, I mean, protest against the violation of Shabbat, including doing business, carrying burdens, and things like that.
It's really from this principle of Siyak.
Whether it's the Siyak Torah or what, I mean, of course, I mean, the Torah doesn't mention that thou shalt not do any business on Shabbos. It doesn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as the Gemara already said in connection with Shabbos, it says that the Torah has a few laws concerning Shabbos, but the few laws, you know, they develop into a massive structure. There's no question about that. All right, let's continue. So anyway, what was the getter? Why? What situation existed over here that they decided that you should have a mikveh? The Tanya, and here's the story. Says, Maisa be'echot shetava yishol edvarbeya. It's a story about a certain guy. He came along and he saw a pretty woman and he propositioned her that, they should have relations. I'm not talking about a married man and a married woman together, you know, I'm talking, okay? He wanted her for illicit relations, okay? So Amar lo, so she said to him, Reiko, she said, oh, you're good for nothing, you. He says, Yesh lecha arboim saw, tell me, and you have handy right now also the 40 saw, you know, in other words, the mikvish ato tevel behen, that you should go and, immediately go into the mikveh, so miyad perash. So immediately he refrained, you know, from committing this violation. So the very fact that the Chachomim gave already, and they said, if you want to, to study Torah, you have to be prepared to immerse yourself in the mikveh. This in itself reminded him of the fact, you know, that there was a higher standard of conduct to which he should have been subject. And therefore, you see, we see the efficacy. This is why, even though 9 kabin of water might have been sufficient, but that wouldn't have been much of a deterrent to this guy. But when he heard about the fact that he would have to go into the mikveh, and not only that, she threw it into his face, you see, she said, well, do you have a mikveh right over here ready? And so on. So he realized how wrong he was, and Perash remained. He refrained, you know, from doing what he had in mind. Right. There are other stories told in him. For example, another rabbi that he also wanted to have a good time with a woman, and so his tzitzis were flapping around. So she took the tzitzis and she flapped them in his face and says, "What's the matter? Doesn't this mean anything to you over here? How could you commit such an aveira? I mean, and here you're wearing tzitzis and so on." So, right. I mean, he was shamed. He realized how wrong he was in his conduct. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, that reminds me, I mean, it's simply as an aside. You know, I grew up wearing my tzitzis under my shirt. So did a lot of other people, okay? Today, of course, we find that the fashion has been established in most of the yeshivas. This is really under the influence of Hasidim, by the way, that, you know, they wear their tzitzis outside. Okay. But it should be obvious that a person wears the tzitzis outside, there's less of a likelihood that he's going to find himself in a place where he has no business being, doing something or not. In other words, this in itself should act as a deterrent to improper conduct. Because I'm not talking about the fact that unfortunately some people still slip in spite of the fact, and we know that there are some from people who they're frum as far as their relations to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is concerned. You know, they're very, very careful about each and every mitzvah. They make sure that the food is only glatt kosher, etc., etc. But when it comes to their dealings with their fellow men, you see, so they're not living up to really what the Yiddishkeit says of them. Of course, this is one of the major things of Yom Kippur, you know,
right,
that the averus that we commit to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam Yom Kippur can
be forgiven.
Forgive, right, but the averus that we commit against our fellow man cannot be forgiven until we actually ask Bechila from them and become at peace with them, right? Okay. Let me go down to the bottom of the page over here and we'll call it a night, okay? Amalu Rav Huna Rabbon. So Rav Huna said to the rabbi, says, Rabbi, he says, tell me, he says, why do you take so lightly this immersion? Now, I think what he's talking about over here is not really the immersion in the mikveh so much as the Tisha Kavin. But maybe it is, all right, let's, because nobody, Tevila by it, normally implies an addiction. Okay. All right, so let's take it in that sense.
I have my reasons why maybe it's a little different, but nevertheless, it doesn't make that much difference. All right. So he says, why do you take it so lightly? That's what mizalzel means. You take it lightly. You make fun of it. You take it lightly. You don't hold it, you know, as being something to to really take earnestly. He says, imishum tzinor. Is it because of the cold? Actually, the point of his question is as follows. He wants to know, look, Ezra gave us a takana, right? You want to study Torah? Immerse yourself in the mikveh. Yet, everybody's trying to do what?
Avoid it.
To avoid it, to get around it. So what he's asking then is, tell me, why do you take it so lightly? Why do you try to avoid, in other words, you know, going into the mikveh? He says, imishum tzino. Is it because the water is cold? So he says, Efshav Bechatzois, in that case, you could immerse yourself in the bathhouse. So Amalei Rab Chisto, so Rab Chisto said to Vechiyesh Tevila Bechamin, he says, are you permitted then to travel in hot water? So Amalei Rab Oda Barabo, so Rab Oda Barabo, he said, Amalei, yeah, so he said unto him, Rab Oda Barabo, Kai Kavoseich, he says, you know what? Rab Oda Barabo is in agreement with you. All right, what? Namely that the water in the mikveh does not have to be absolutely ice cold, but it could be warmed up sufficiently so at least you know that you feel comfortable. Tolerable. Right. Rabbi Zeira havi yosid ba'agda demayo. So now they tell the story about Rabbi Zeira who was sitting in a tub of water. Bay Masusa, and where was this tub of water? It was in the bathhouse. Okay? So so he said to his servant, he says, Zil v'yitzali tishakabim v'shadi alui. So he said to him, go and bring me 9 kabin of water and pour it on me. So omalei rabbi chia barabos, rabbi chia barabos said to him, lomalei lamar kulei hai, tell me, he says, why do you have to go to so much of an effort? As much as you're already sitting in a bathtub which already contains fish of carbon of water. Right. So why do you have to go to the additional one? So so Amalei says the answer is it's ka'arboyim saw. It's like the question of the 40 saw. As we said, this with a mikra, right? Ma arboim so'ah, just as in the case of the din concerning the mikveh, that you have to have a minimum of 40 so'ah, and it has to be bitvila, that's for immersion in the mikveh, right? The lobe in the sinon, and you can't take, for example, 40 so'ah of water and just pour it over, that you can't do, that's not going into the mikveh, even though you could have the same quantity of water, but it's not the same, it has to be done the right way.
Okay,
you understand?
Right.
So. Yeah. So af tisha kabin. So likewise, in the case of the 9 kabin, it's been exceeded. It has to be poured below betfila, not immersed. In other words, the fact that I'm sitting in the bath, this is like immersion, so to speak. But that doesn't fulfill the law, which says it has to be poured.
Yes,
right. Rab Nachman tikin chatzva bas tisha kabin. Rab Nachman made a pitcher which can contain 9 kabin. In other words, he measured out a pitcher, you know, in which he knows that there are 9 kabin of water. And, you know, this way, you know, you take the pitcher and you give a pour from the pitcher and you know that you have the minimum required. Okay? So, he also, Rab Dimi, when Rab Dimi came to Eretz Yisrael, so Omar, he said that Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehuda, Glustra, that these two Rabbonim, Omru, they said, Leishonuel Elochela Leonsai. They said that this is only for someone who is sick, and he has, unfortunately, an omission, you know, but it's not something that he himself, deliberately brought on. But if he happens to be a sick person, but nevertheless, you know, he was fooling around, okay, and he induced his own seminal omission, then Arboim Sonnen, in that case, the 9 kabin are not enough. Then he requires 40 son. So Omar Rav Yosef, when Rav Yosef heard that, he says, it's bar chatzvid Rav Nachman. In that case, he says, the pitcher Rav Nachman is broken. In other words, what good does it do?
Because the average person, normally, I mean, why does he have a seminal mission?
Because he wants it.
Because he's having it, he wants it. I mean, he desires it.
There wasn't
so
an accident.
So what would be the point? Right, it's not accidental. So therefore, it's not sufficient. And therefore, it requires 40 souls. So what good does it do?
Good argument.
Yeah, so okay. Also Robin. So when Robin came from Israel, Omar, he said, but Ushahabdu, he says, that happened, that there's a maisa that happened. The kilo, which means literally on the entrance to the porch, the Rabbi Shaya. And also the Shaulu, the Rabbi Asi. So they came and they asked Rabbi Asi, you know, Maluhu, and he said unto them, Leishonu l'chayla ha-magil. He said, the nine kabin is only for a sick person who, you know, deliberately induces it. Avol l'chayla le'onsei. But if he is a sick person, and unfortunately he has a seminal emission, you know, not by his own volition, then in that case he's put them a klum, and in that case he doesn't have to do anything. He can learn Torah all that he wants, but he does not have to immerse himself or have the nine carbon poured upon him. All right, we'll stop over here. We're almost getting finished with the Takot HaSesra. Yes.
I just wanted to ask you,
top of top base on the base, but I just want to summarize a couple of things that we had. So I'm starting from the bottom of top base on the bottom. Right, the bottom of Chof Beis on the Aleph. Okay, remember that there's been a big issue for several blocks already, and I don't know, one of these days we'll get out of that issue. That is Takonas Ezra. Mm-hmm. The fact that he says, if you want to learn Torah, or if you want to daven, right, say Krishna and so on, daven, then in that particular case, and you are a Valkyrie, in other words, you've had a nocturnal emission, a seminal emission. I thank you.
You're right.
Nocturnal sometimes implies that it's involuntary, whereas they're really covering the whole gamut. But as we'll see, that they will make a distinction to a certain extent. Anyway, according to the Takonas Ezra, before you can do it, you have to table yourself in the mikvah. Okay, otherwise you cannot either learn Torah. Or, as he said, you cannot even say Krishna, according to him, because Krishna, too, is like learning Torah. So, this was what the Takana Vesper was. And, of course, many of the rabbis tried to adhere to it, until, as we saw, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira came along, and he said, in any case, you can't observe it anymore. But the Gemara is now backtracking again in order to find out what did Ezra actually say. This is what they want to find out, okay? And at the same time, remember that, in the oral tradition, they had different oral traditions that had come down. One of them, if you remember, spoke about instead of having to go into the mikveh and tibel, it would be enough, and that remember, is 40 soha, right? So it's enough to have simply tishah kabin, which is a much smaller quantity. It's like saying, let's say, 4 quarts versus 40 gallons or something like that. You understand? Or 9 quarts, all right? Let's say 9 quarts versus 40 gallons of water, okay? And, if it's poured over you, then that accomplishes the same result, okay? So the question is, how can we harmonize all these different things? This is what they're dealing with at this particular moment.
Take a shower.
Huh?
Take a shower.
Yeah, a shower, right. Except that they said, if you remember, he said the question was asked, for example, can you do it in the bathhouse? And they tell the story of, this Rav who was there, and he told the shamans to go and pour it over here. So they said, v'chi yesh tvila b'chamin, tell me, is it possible to have immersion, let's say, in a mikveh with hot water or not? And they said, so he said to him, no, as a matter of fact, the story is this, that they said that, and this is right at the bottom, he says, Ma'ar boyim sona b'tfilo, if we're going to have 40, so, or this is the, right near the end over there, 2.5 lines from the bottom, 3 lines from the bottom, all right, it says, Mar boim sodom bitvilo, that just as you need the 40 saw of water in order to immerse itself in that quantity of water, below benesida, and it cannot simply be poured over you. I mean, you can't take 40 saw of water and just pour over you. So, likewise, aftisha kabin benesino, if we hold this business, that it's enough to simply take 9 kabin of water, it has to be poured, right, below bitbila, and you cannot immerse yourself just in 9 kabin of water. So, it seems sensible. All right. So at any rate, we'll see that we haven't really resolved the issue sufficiently as yet.
Who said it has to be sensible?
Thank you, me.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to see that in reality we haven't really solved it. But however, the last thing that we read was the story about Rav Nachman. That's 2.5 lines from the bottom. Rav Nachman tikkun chatzvo bas tisha kabin. Says that Rav Nachman fixed up a pitcher which contained 9 kabin. Okay? In other words, he accepted the idea that it would be simply enough to simply pour this, and so he constructed a special pitcher, which could hold this much water, so that they knew this is the shear. In other words, he has an exact shear, and all he has to do is just to have it poured over in order to be able to achieve tara. Okay? So, ganz fine. Ki yosa Rav Dimi. So when Rav Dimi came to Bavel from Eretz Israel, so Omar, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehuda, Glustra, Omru Leishonvel L'chayla Leyonza. So he reported that both Rabbi Akiva and a certain Rabbi Yehuda Glustra, who's not the same as Rabbi Yehuda in Ben Becerra, they're different Rabbi Yehudas, you see, okay? So this Rabbi Yehuda Glustra, together with Rabbi Akiva, said that when they said that the 9 kabin are sufficient in order to affect Tara so that you can continue with learning Torah, etc., etc., they were referring only L'chayle L'onso, which means a person who was sick, and as a result of his illness, he had a seminal emission, without actually, having stimulated himself, to the extent that this is the reason why it was due to his illness. So in that case, according to Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehuda Glustra, then the 9 kabin are enough for him. Avol l'chayla hamagilar, l'chayla hamagil, if a person was ill, but he stimulated himself, as I say, either through intercourse with his wife, or God forbid, for any other reason, okay? So, at any rate, for him, it isn't enough except our boy himself. You have to have, a full mikveh, he has to immerse himself, even though he was a sick person.
No way you can have a seminal emission unless you're stimulated. Impossible.
Yeah, well.
Even in your dreams.
No, right, okay. But you and I know that there are times, when.
It may be involuntary.
Right, it's involuntary.
It's a stimulation
time,
of
right.
It's a biological impossibility.
Okay, whatever. You have good thoughts, Sometimes a good thought will bring it on. Okay. All right, so. Well, I can conceive of the fact, let's say a person is suffering from a fever or something like that, and all kinds of mishugan ideas go through his head.
Well, that's a different story.
So that on this case, I would consider him, as a chayda leonso. This is the way I would consider him.
Okay.
All right, at any rate, Omer Rab Yosef, Rab Yosef said, Itpach Hatzvi, the Rab Nachman, he says, hey, Rab Nachman, guess what? Your pitcher is broken. In other words, what good is it? The 9 kabin, because if we say
he made a football.
Right, if it's only for someone who is a chayla leonso instead of for anybody who's had a seminal emission, then in that case there's no point to it, you see. So he also Robin, then when Robin came back from Eretz Israel, he reported as follows. He says, Oma B'Yusha Abud, he says, you know what, the following event took place in Usha. Usha is in northern Galilee, and Usha is in northern Galilee, and there was one of the places where they built a yeshiva. The Sanhedrin was there too for a while, and so on, because after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, Matter of fact, even prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin already was preparing, you know, to move to other localities. And so they did move to other localities because they wanted to keep up the Sanhedrin, even though the Beis HaMikdash itself had been destroyed by the Romans. But they still wanted to retain the Sanhedrin, retain its authority. So wherever great Rabbonim came and they established, you know, a continuation of the yeshivas, so that's where they established the Sanhedrin. So that, for example, the first one, you know, after the destruction of Beis HaMikdash would have been the one that was established in Yavne. And then afterwards the Roman authorities forced them to move up to northern Galilee where they were less subject to Roman persecution. So they settled in Husha, they settled in Sephora, the different places where they were. All right, so Robin said, you know, I was in Husha, he says, and it happened, Haba'udha means literally, an event occurred, okay, Bekila de Rav Oshaya, in Rav Oshaya's Kila. Now, of course, what is Kila? Kila doesn't mean over here a rupture.
No,
it doesn't mean Kehila either. Rashi explains that Kila, he says, is Kenisas Habayas. He says, this is at the entrance to the house, there was a Cheder Shilifnei HaTraklin. There was a room which is before you go into the parlor, okay? Shekorin Portigo Belas. In other words, according to Rashi, this is more like a porch, okay? So in other words, the Chachomim was sitting on a porch before going into the house, okay? They were gathered outside on the porch. Maybe it was nice and warm at that time, very informal. Maybe it so happened that Rav Oshaya's wife was serving a lemonade or something. Who knows? Right, or maybe aperitifs. So he says, you know, there we were sitting, Vishalu the Rav Asi, and they asked this question of Rav Asi. So Amaluhu. So he said to them, Lo shonu ela l'chayla hamagil. He said, no, this business about the Tisha Kabin, he says, that applies only to a sick person who brought on his own seminal emotion. You know, who he did it, you know, deliberately, okay? But if there's a sick person and he had, you know, a seminal emission with which was completely involuntary, then in that particular case is part of the klum. Then he doesn't have to do anything in order to, you know, to daven, let's say, to say Krishna, to learn Torah, whatever it may be. All right, so gone's fine. So far, as we see, there are two conflicting opinions, right?
Can I just take
this? Sure.
I'm sorry, this is off the track, but I'm curious about Kila.
Yeah.
If you remember your days at Kibbutz Lavi and the base Knesset there,
yeah.
But a Kila be what is in the middle, that sort of open courtyard that they have? You know, they have like the big Knesset on one side and the big Midrash on the other, and then there's like, which is supposedly the design of the Tei Knesset and the Galil during this period.
I wouldn't be able to answer that question because, first of all, I don't remember that the Beis Medrash and the Shul were different from the last time that I was in Kibbutz Lavi, which was about 4 years ago. They may have changed, you know, the layout since that time. Okay? So that's one thing. The other thing is this. I visited several shuls in the Galil, you know, and I'm talking about, you know, the ancient ones. You know, which today stand empty or they're in ruins in reality. Now, from what I recall, I mean, they had the women's gallery, I remember. They had in the front a great high bima that you had to go up the steps where presumably the Aron Kodesh was and so on. And but in the middle, I don't remember an empty space unless you mean that people would stand rather than sit or something like that.
Oh, not in the big castle.
No.
They have in the... You know, they have like a middle space that was like a
courtyard.
Yeah, basically a courtyard.
Yeah. Uh huh.
Well, it's either here or there.
I don't know. I'm not sure. But as I say, Rashi, as I said, takes them to central porch. I don't know whether everybody else is in agreement, but look, I'll certainly rely upon Rashi. Okay. So, at any rate, Rabbi Yosef said, it's Tamid Chatzvei the Rab Nachman. Oh, he says, you know, now in that particular case, then Rab Nachman's picture has been
patched up again. Meaning, of course, that if we say that a chole lipon so doesn't have to do anything, right? He's potem, you know, miklum. So in that case, we say then that the chole hamargil, what about him? With him, you know, for him, it's 9 kapin in order to, you know, pour over him in order to make him fit, you know, again, in order to daven or to learn, whatever it may be, okay? So in that case, then the 9 kapin pitcher is going to be effective again, okay? So now they want to get back again to, as we'll see, to Ezra's takana. What actually did Ezra say? So, Michte. Michte means, all right, let's take a look. Let's consider. Kulhu Amoroi v'tanoi b'te Ezra kamiflike. It says, all these Amoroim and all the Tanoim, all of them were in conflict with each other as to what was actually the takona of Ezra. Or how to apply the takona of Ezra, right? So he says, v'nechsei Ezra. So look, let's take a look at Ezra and find out what kind of a takana did he actually make. So about this again, the rabbis are in disagreement. What actually was the nature of the takana of Ezra? We think we all know it. We know he made a takana.
What does takana mean?
Ah, a takana means that you make a ruling which is accepted by people, right? This is a takana, okay? Literally, it's in the word, you know, the takein, which means to fix up something. In other words, Ezra saw that there was a situation that required fixing up, and so he made a takana that, you know, should help resolve the difficulties in this particular situation, okay? But we always take it, you know, in the later sense, that a takana is something that has been, it's a rule or regulation which has been established for the benefit of the community or for whatever it may be, and people are expected to abide by the takana. Okay? Alright, so now actually he says, what was Ezra's takana? The same takana, you know, about which the Amoraim are in disagreement and the Tanoim. Remember again, who are the Amoraim and who are the Tanoim? The Tanoim are the earlier teachers, the earlier Rabbonim. They are the ones, you know, who are in the Mishnah. The authorities of the Mishnah. The Amoraim, these are the authorities that came after the Tanoim, and these are the authorities who are mentioned primarily in the Gemara, because they were already later than the time of the Mishnah. Now, generally speaking, the Tanoim, you know, try to resolve it according to the way they understood it, and then the Amoraim come along and try to explain what was the reasoning of the Tanoim in the previous generations and see whether it applies to, you know, what was the current theories that they had about it. Alright, so they are now going to discuss again the Takana of Ezra. So Amar Abaye, and about this we see there are differences of opinion. Abaye said as follows, he says, Ezra tikein the Bori Amargil Memso Bori Li Onso Tes Kapi. Alright, so first comes Abaye's opinion. Abaye's opinion is as follows, that the takana that Ezra decreed was for somebody who was a healthy man and who brought on, you know, his own seminal emission. Okay? So, for him, before he could sit down and, you know, either say, you know, learn Torah or say Krishna, whatever it may be, what did we say in his particular case? He requires memsoa. In other words, he requires the villa, he requires immersion in a mikvah which contains a minimum of 40 soa. Okay? Let's say it would be, let's say, 40 gallons or something like that. Okay? In our terms. Alright. So, this is Abaye's opinion that the takona of Ezra was, first of all, that, you know, if a person is healthy, alright, then he required 40 soa. Right? But uvori li'on. So, what if he were a healthy person but the emission came on accidentally? Then in that particular case, it is teskabin. Okay? So this was the original decree, that is the teskabin, as we say, you know, the smaller quantity, right? The 9 quarts.